So yeah, this may be a two week topic. Fine. It is Parshas Bichukosai, and you have a few choices when you hit this parsha at the end of Sefer Vayikra. One choice is to talk about the Tochacha, the warnings of punishment, which occupy the bulk of the parsha. What happens if you don't listen to God, and what happens if you continue not to listen to God? And it's a fascinating section in its own right. The similarities, the differences between this and the version of the Tochacha that they get the second time when they're about to enter Israel in Parshas Kisavo, because they are fundamentally different warnings. Or you can deal with some of the small issues that show up at the end of the parsha, which are fascinating and nobody ever pays attention to. And I thought I was going to do that, but then decided no. We're doing instead choice three, which is the beginning of the parsha. And so what you see here in source number one, which we're not going to read entirely inside, but I'm going to sum up for you. It says, "Im chukosai telechu, if you follow my laws, if you guard my mitzvos, then I'm going to give you rain. Your fields are going to do well. Your fields are going to do really, really well. You will have a lot of bread. You will sit securely. Nobody will frighten you. All your enemies will be chased away. You will chase your enemies away. Everything is going to be wonderful. I will live among you. I am Hashem, your God, who took you out of Egypt, and I'm going to bring you back into your land. Komimiyut. You will be able to walk with your head held high. You will not live under anybody's yoke." And so on. It's a wonderful, wonderful vision. Everything is great.
Wait, what does Komaniyut mean?
Right, so Komaniyut. Okay, so it's usually understood to mean upright. Right? That's how they say, Komaniyut Le'artenu. Right, you should. It's built off of here. I will lead you upright. That you're not bowed over before anybody. That's the idea. So, these promises of material bounty are great. The Rambam writes in source number two, and in terms of the question of why some sources on these sheets are translated and some are not, by and large, I think what I did was the ones that I took from other source sheets of mine are translated, but I didn't decide to translate anything new. And I think I even took out some to fit it on these pages. But we'll explain everything as we go along, and it should be all right. But there's no rhyme or reason, really, behind which things are translated and which are not. But in source number two, the Rambam speaks about this material benefit that we're promised here, and he says, you should know, the things that are outlined here are not really the rewards for mitzvos. And the warnings of punishment that show up in the Tochacha, those are not actually the punishment for failing to fulfill the mitzvos. Rather, what these are promises that if you start out on a good path, Hashem is going to make it easier for you to continue on a good path. So if you fulfill the mitzvos, then Hashem is going to make sure that you have what you need. Your plans grow, your enemies are chased away, and therefore you'll be able to continue to do mitzvos. And in the event that you stray, then none of that. You won't have it easy at all. Hashem is actually going to make it harder for you. That's the way the Rambam looks at this. This isn't about reward and punishment. However, the bulk of the world looks at it as reward and punishment. And that leads to the question, here and in the rest of the Chumash, of why we don't get a clear expression of Olam Haba. Gan Eden, Gehenim. The phrase of Olam Haba is kind of a loaded phrase, because Olam Haba gets used in different ways, in different contexts. Sometimes it means what happens after Mashiach comes, and sometimes it means what happens after death. So I don't like using the phrase. But it is a good sort of catch-all. But there's no discussion of after a person leaves this world, they either go to a place of great pleasure in the next world, or punishment, or bonding with Hashem, or distance from Hashem. You don't really get an explicit discussion. So much so that the anthropologists argue that it's because the Chumash doesn't believe in it. Right? You've heard this idea? Yeah, the anthropologists, secular anthropologists, argue that that's because the Chumash doesn't really believe that the Torah that there is such a thing as life after death. And within that school, what they argue is that the Chumash believes that any sort of neshama that we have is really just like something like the body. It's just breath of life that is that is really physical and ends when the body ends. And they argue it isn't until like the time of the Greeks and then the church and all of that that you have the idea of an immortal soul that outlives the body. So clearly, to me at any rate, the anthropologists are incorrect. This is not a correct read of the policy of Tanakh or Chumash when it comes to life after death. I brought you a number three. Several psukim or a few sources on this. First of all, from Navi, just to show it within Nach. So first in number three, you have the story of Shaul and the Baalat Ov. Right? You familiar with that story? Mm-hmm. Known in English usually as the Witch of Endor. Right? Does that ring a bell? At all?
Not
really. No. Oh boy. Shaul, in his later phase, when he's having trouble with the fact that David has been coronated, and Shmuel is already dead, and Shaul needs guidance. So he says, I'm going to go get guidance from Shmuel. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to go to this woman, this Ov, who is able to summon the dead and ask them questions. And that's what he does. And she at first doesn't want, he disguises himself, and she at first doesn't want to do it because Shaul has actually gotten rid of this sort of practice in Israel, and she says, I can get punished for doing this. And he says, don't worry about it, you won't get punished. And she calls up Shmuel. And that's what you see there in the first two lines in source number three. Like, she's successful, which tells me that the Navi believes that people survive their death. Otherwise, how does that work? Or the prediction in Daniel, the last parak in Daniel, in which Hashem says that in the future, those who have been buried in the ground are going to come back to life. The Trias HaMesim. You have other passages, Yechezkel on the dry bones, the Atzimot HaYavesha. You can come up with other examples, but even within the Chumash, it's fairly clear that the soul is distinct from the body. Your first source on it is in number four. When Hashem creates Adam, and it says, Vayipach be'apav nishmas chayim, Hashem breathed into Adam the breath of life. The neshama as separate from the body. That's your starting point. But it continues to talk about what happens after death. If you continue in number four, Chanoch. Right? Chanoch is this odd figure between the time of Adam and the time of Noah. And we are told about him, Vayishaleh Chanoch es ha'elokim, he walked with God, ve'einenu, and he was no longer kilakach es ha'elokim, because God took him. If it meant death, it would have said that. It said death for his father, grandfather, great-grandfather. It said death for his son and grandson. Why doesn't it say death here? God took him? Suggesting that there's an idea of some kind of other result for him. Something special is assigned to him. There's more to be said about Chanoch. Maybe I shouldn't even use him as an example because he's kind of unique. But if you take a look at the next source, you find Hashem's promise that he makes to Abraham, Ve'ata tavo al avosecha b'shalom. You, Abraham, he's describing what's going to happen to Abraham's descendants, and he says, you, Abraham, you will come to your ancestors in peace. What is the meaning of the phrase, come to your ancestors? If the ancestors are dead, and that's it, that's what happens after death. What does that even mean? Right? Suggests that something happens. The fact that the Torah tells you about a punishment called kares, right, that a person will be cut off, as opposed to when it says a person will die, suggests there's some kind of spiritual severing that is going on. But the best example for me, the best evidence of it, is the last source in number four, where we're told about various practices we're not supposed to engage in. Sorcery, fortune-telling, picking particular times of day as being good for doing certain things or bad for doing other things. Witchcraft, charming animals, inquiring of an Ov and a Yidoni, and Doresh El Hamesim, that last one. What is Doresh El Hamesim? What does that mean?
Seeking advice from the dead.
Right, consulting the dead. Right, you're not allowed to ask people who have died for guidance. Right, different from the Ov in the sense that that there are techniques that are different, but you're not allowed to ask those who have passed away for guidance. This is very, very interesting from a completely different context. Right. So for centuries and centuries, there's been a lot of debate about going to a grave to daven. There's a lot of fear in halachic sources that people will come to either do this, Darish HaLameisim, or that they're actually going to view the dead as some sort of god with their own power. And so there were many poskim who prohibited going to graves. At the same time, the practice was defended for centuries and centuries by those who said, no, that's clearly not what we're doing. What we're doing is davening to Hashem in the merit of the people who are buried there. You know, the asking even for someone to be a Melitz Yosher, that they should be, you know, an agent on our behalf, is not the same thing as looking to them to change the universe, or, you know, asking them for counsel. And so it's been. So there's definitely an idea in not just halacha, but in Torah in general, that physical location matters. It isn't only about what you're thinking, but being in particular places has an impact. You know, the idea that davening at the Kotel actually should, although it doesn't for everybody, but it should mean something to me. Even though I can picture the Kotel in my mind, nonetheless, being at a particular place can help focus and can have significance, and especially if you're looking for the merit that is somehow associated with it, whether because the tzaddik is buried there or because of some major event that happens there. When you learn Navi, right, you know, we're going to see this in the Shmuel Shir this afternoon, you find that the Jews keep going back to a place called Mitzpah to gather for significant moments in their history. And Radak believes that's the same mitzvah where Yehoshua had a great victory against the kings of Canaan, and the Jews keep coming back there because that spot is special for us. They could have gathered anywhere, but they chose a spot that had some kind of significance. So the idea that going to the grave is going to have special meaning, I think, is... I don't think that's wrong. I think that there is something to be said for that, even though the neshama is clearly not bound to the particular spot. But the thing that I want to note here in number four in this last source, Doresh Al HaMeisim, tell me, if the Torah doesn't believe that people survive their own death, how would someone be Doresh Al HaMeisim?
Yeah. I think you could just think, like, what would that person advise me if they were still alive? I don't think this Doresh Al HaMeisim means that there's an afterlife.
See, the problem that I have with that is that you're splitting culture from halacha, by which I mean, it's true that the Rambam believes that you can't be Doresh Al HaMeisim, meaning the Rambam thinks the whole thing is a joke. Rambam says you're not allowed to engage in these practices, not because they are in any way, shape, or form meaningful, but because a Jew is not allowed to be a fool. And it can lead you to Avodah Zarah. As far as the Rambam is concerned, I know people have a hard time with that mitzvah. But as far as the Rambam is concerned, this doesn't work. Nonetheless, even the Rambam has to acknowledge that the milieu in which the people are functioning who are learning this is one in which it's common belief that in fact they do survive. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a concept. You can't tell me that this is prohibiting me from saying what would so-and-so have suggested.
No, but even if you're talking about like these magical forces that can bring up dead bodies, like the non-Jewish people also had that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that they have some kind of neshama that's still living. It means that there's some... It could be yes, but it could also be that they're still now able to bring up like a ghostly form of the person.
Right, but the people who are... That's why I want to distinguish between the halacha and the culture. The people who are learning this, the Jews who are receiving the Torah, are of the belief that the neshama persists. In other words, what the anthropologists are arguing is that Jews didn't believe that at this point in our history. And my response is, of course they did. Because they believed that they were doing it. Whether it was something that other cultures had also, and whether it works or not, is really beside the point. And that's what I mean when I say that the halacha and the culture are two different issues here. The question of, is it usr or mutter, does it work or not, is separate from the fact that the Jews who are hearing Moshe speak absolutely think that Doresh Al HaMeisim is a thing. They believe that there is a concept of talking to the dead, and not simply the Canaanim and Mitzrim or whatever believed that they could do it, but no, this is something that we think is a concept, that the Meisim are not simply gone forever.
Yeah, but everyone in those days thought that.
That's not what the anthropologists will tell you.
No, but I'm saying, when you look at it like that, that culturally, that the Jews in those days thought this, that's why there's a mitzvah not to do it, because they actually believed it. But in those days, the Mitzrayim also believed it. The Canaanim also believed it. So not necessarily the stemming from the Torah, but from the general view of the times.
Yeah.
But what I'm right, so I hear what you're saying. But number one, the Torah doesn't say to you at some point this doesn't work.
But it doesn't
the Torah doesn't
about
disagree with it
either.
No, but I'm saying, again, what I'm trying to get at is not this is the answer to why the Torah doesn't discuss afterlife. That's coming next. What I'm trying to get at is don't take the Torah's silence on afterlife as a statement that their culture didn't believe it, because that's just not so. But in terms of who believed what and when, like I could you know give you material to read on it, but it's all absolute kfira. So you have to know that. But no, they will argue that in our society at that point in time, Jews didn't think it. Egyptians are a different story. Egyptian thought is different from what they attribute to ours. But my point here is simply that the Jews of the time absolutely believe that the soul persists, the neshama persists after one dies. Where it goes, what happens to it, the Torah is not telling me. Whatever the cultural beliefs are, who knows? But the question then that you have to ask is, so if that's true, if we're right that Jews at that time believe in this, and that the Torah ultimately believes in an Olam Haba, why doesn't it say so? Why is that just like, you know, and again, I said in the beginning, the Rambam believes that all the rewards in Bechukosai are not really rewards. The Torah is not describing reward. The Torah is describing how Hashem will enable you to continue to fulfill mitzvahs, or how Hashem will make it harder for you.
Which is a question that also comes back to, we have this question like every other week, which is like, Tzadik or Rabbah, like people who have terrible
yes.
lives, so that means that what Hashem doesn't want them to do mitzvahs and
in the afterlife. Right, so should I go through same answer that we go through every other week? Yeah. Yes. Okay. So there are, as I said, a lot of answers. There's a lot of material on this, and it's more than we can get to in 1 hour, or you know whatever is left of 1 hour after everybody's been busy arriving. Because we also say that every other week. First of all, an opening answer before we get to the main answers, because this is a fascinating point. Abar Benel on our Parsha goes through 7 different approaches to this. And a lot of what I quote here is going to involve him and his summations, along with, as I show you, who else says offers those answers. So Abar Benel's last answer that he quotes is number 5 on the sheet. Hatshuva Hashmiit, he says the 7th answer. You see that? He says the 7th answer is that Hayudim Hagashmiim Shinizkru B'divrei HaBrit Hazeh. These material, physical rewards that are mentioned in the covenant in Bechukosai, Lo Haya Efshar Sheikanes Bem Shum Yud Ruchani Klal. He couldn't have included a promise of spiritual reward. Because Bechukosai is talking about what's going to happen to the nation as a whole. If you collectively fulfill the mitzvos, this is what's going to happen to you. Having a lot of rain, having the produce grow, defeating your enemies. And the other things mentioned here, kulam heim kolalim el ha'uma. These are collective. They're for the population as a whole. Whereas the promise of what's going to happen to the neshama, those apply to each Jew individually. When you're dealing with material things, so God looks at the majority of the population, majority of the city, majority of the nation, majority of the world, and says, okay, so here's what I'm going to send. And that's what's found in our parsha. Not the individual fate. The Sefer Karim says this as well, or Yosef Albo. Now, this is not one of what I conclude as the main answers, simply because this works for our Parsha. Okay, so in this context, it didn't make sense to mention Olam Haba. But what about the rest of the Chumash? Not all of the Chumash is speaking about the collective. Some of it is speaking to the individual. You could have mentioned it somewhere else. So it's a nice answer, but it's really only local. It only addresses the Chukosai. So I think in order to get a grip on this, I think we first have to go back to something we discussed way back in Parshas Bereishis. Right, everyone remembers what we discussed in Parshas Bereishis. The Shiva, you're coming in now, so you're exempt. You can catch up on the audio recordings later. We talked about why the Torah tells us anything that is not halacha. Why does the Torah ever say anything that isn't halacha? Right, remember the Midrashim in the beginning of Bereishis, right? Why doesn't the Torah start HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem? Here is your first national mitzvah, and proceed from there. Why is it that I get all these stories? So we noted Rashi and Ramban had two different views based on the same Midrash. To make a long story short, I didn't even bother to bring it again on the sheet. Rashi's view is that Ramban in number 6 is the same as the Barbanel in number 5. Ramban has the same idea that the Torah here is talking about what happens for the nation as a whole, not the individual. So number 6 is like number 5. Sorry. Going back to this, Rashi says that the goal of Bereishis is to explain that Hashem gave us Canaan. Ramban says it's in order to teach us proper behavior, to calibrate. So you see what happens in Sefer Bereishis, what Hashem likes and what Hashem doesn't like, and now you know for yourself, these are the things I'm supposed to do, these are the things I'm not supposed to do. Either way, whether I take Rashi, that is to explain that Hashem gave us Canaan and that's our land and where we're supposed to live and so on, or I take the view of Ramban, which is that it's in order to teach us proper behavior, either way, the goal of the non-halachic portions of the Torah is to encourage halachic behavior. It's to get me to do what Hashem wants me to do. It's not just stories. It's not just, hey, feel good today. There's a promise that you'll get rain when you're supposed to get rain and your fields will grow and whatever it is. And it's not just, you know, here's a downer. You should know when you do bad things happen. It's meant to get us to do the things that Hashem wants us to do. That's the agenda in Chumash. And so the explanations of why the Torah does not present Olam Haba here, / in general, are largely that it wouldn't help encourage halachic behavior in one way or another, as we'll see. Yeah. Go ahead.
Is that true? Yeah, because we knew that we were going to get more in the world and probably didn't think that we would be halachic.
So that's what we have to talk about. But that's what all of the answers can be summed up as. All the answers that we're going to give are fundamentally along those lines, and we'll have to just figure out how that's true. But that's the basic sort of theme. You can break down the explanations into three different categories, and that's what we'll do, and then we'll get to the Kuzari, but there's no way we're getting to the Kuzari today, which is too bad, because this answer is fascinating and wildly different from everybody else's. The three categories of explanation are, number one, it won't encourage halachic behavior, because everybody knew about Olam Haba anyway, because of all the sources that we read. I'm going to unpack this and show like where these views are taken and so on, because there are nuances within them. But the first basic approach is, the Torah doesn't talk about it, because it's not going to encourage good behavior, because everybody knew about this anyway. The second approach is that Olam Haba is not really a good incentive for good conduct in this world. Olam Haba just doesn't work as an incentive. That's your second overarching school. And your third approach is talking about Olam Haba will actually lead us to bad behavior. It will be counterproductive. The Kuzari is a thing unto himself. The Kuzari's answer basically is that Olam Haba is in this world. And obviously I have to explain what that means. But sorry, there's no way. There's absolutely no way. Okay. So let's get through something at least. So the first school of thought, everybody knew back in the day about spiritual life after death and so on. Rav Haigon in source number 7 is quoted in Ibn Ezra. Rabbeinu Haizal Omar, Kilo Hutzra Hakasav Lafarish Dvar HaOlam Haba. Wasn't necessary to say it. It was known by transmission, by tradition. Everybody knew about it. That's Rav Hai Gaon's answer, 10th century. And even earlier than him, Rav Sadja Gaon said it in source number 8. Rav Sadja Gaon writes, V'im yomar omer, if someone will say, Hein lo nimtza mash nizkar b'torah min ha-gemul ki im ba'olam hazeh bilvad, the Torah's rewards are all this worldly things. So he said, L'shtei sibot, that's for two reasons. Achas mehena, one of them is, Shegmul ha'olam haba, mibnei shein omdin alav ki im b'seichel kasher be'arnu, lo zecharasu ha-Torah ki im b'ktsara. He says, this is his first reason or his second reason? I wanted his first here. I did want his first here. He says, the idea of reward in the next world is something that you just get intellectually. And therefore, the Torah only mentions it briefly. Meaning, just trying to figure out if it, it is what Rav Hai Gaon says, but now I'm reading his words and wondering if that's exactly what he meant. What he's trying to say is that it's something that you only grasp intellectually. It's not something that you perceive. It's not something that you see. And therefore, the Torah doesn't spend a lot of time on it. I'm actually wondering now whether he's really saying the same thing as Rav Hai Gaon. It could be that he's saying something different from Rav Hai Gaon, but what he's saying is actually, you can't perceive it, and therefore, it's not going to work as an incentive. Sort of one of the other ideas that we're going to see later. I suspect that that's actually a better framing. He's not really saying what Rav Hai Gaon is saying. So scratch that. We're going to come back to it later. Not for now. But Rav Hai Gaon is saying what Rav Hai Gaon says. He's saying a very pshat approach. It's a very simple approach. You don't tell people about things that they know anyway. You tell people about the things that they wouldn't know. That if they work, if they serve Hashem, then their fields are going to grow well. That's not something they would have anticipated on their own. You tell people that Hashem will reward you when your neshama continues in the next world. Yeah, we all culturally believe that anyway, so I don't need the Torah to talk about that. Abarbanel has a slightly different take on this in number 9. He says, Atshuva Ashlishis, the third out of his 7. He says, the idea that the soul continues after this world, and that it's rewarded in accordance with whatever it accomplished in this world, that's natural. That's normal. He says the idea that the soul is going to persist and achieve levels and all of that, that's not something you get just from religion. He says that this idea is just logical. It's natural that you grow in certain levels. And he says the philosophers have already taken this idea as well. And so he says, when the Torah wants to talk about reward or punishment, it doesn't want to talk about natural consequences of your actions, which is what he believes Olam Haba is. He says that's not a reward. Olam Haba is not a reward. It's just what happens. It's to be expected. In the same way that the Torah is not going to warn if somebody steps out a window, they're going to fall to the ground and smash. And the Torah doesn't bother to tell you that. That's gravity. So he says the Torah doesn't tell you that if you do bad things, then your soul is going to suffer after this life. The Torah doesn't bother to tell you that because that's just to be expected. That's natural. Only that which is unusual, that which changes nature, Hashem intervening to send you the rains or whatever it is, those are things that Hashem is going to want to spell out within the Chumash. Things.
Just say it's natural because you can't know that it happens.
Well, that doesn't make it not natural. That just means it's not observable, right? But he says of course this happens. Like philosophically, it makes perfect sense. Once you believe in a soul that is separate from the body, the idea that the soul should stop when the body stops doesn't make any sense. I mean, they looked at the soul as different from, separate from the body, which is what everybody did until modern times. You know, so as far as he's concerned, like, why do I need to talk about it?
they also had a connection with Hashem, like they had Nevi'im, they had people who spoke to him. Like, you don't have any of that up and down relationship that they had.
Right. This is true, and that's going to come back in the Kuzari a little bit.
But the Barbanel didn't have that, and to him it's so clear.
Right.
That's like 1400s.
Right, and he spent his life in Tanakh, but yes. The
right, no, but I'm saying if you can't say, oh, the absence of Nevi'im is...
Right, no, that's true.
Of course it helps to have a connection with him.
But keep in mind, he's explaining the Chumash. He's not talking about his own day. But that's the idea as far as he is concerned. And Ramban, in source number 10, is along the same lines. He says it's perfectly natural that the neshama should continue. Ramban in number 10 is explaining the concept of kares, the idea that when people die, that if somebody sins, then they could be cut off. The neshama should be cut off. So he says all of this is actually straightforward. I'm going to jump to the middle of the source where he says v'tam ha'inyan. He says the idea here is ki nishmas ha'adam ner Hashem asher nubcha be'apeinu mipi elyon v'nishmat shakai. He says the nishama of a human being, the candle of God, which is exhaled into us, Hashem blows it into us. Kmo shenema v'yipach v'apav nishmas chayim, as it says regarding Adam. So the neshama is as it is. The neshama is not going to die. The nenem were keves. It's not made of different components. Shati parade har kavasa, such that it should break up, decompose. That it should, have a cause for it to come into existence or to be destroyed, like things that are made from multiple units. He says it lasts forever, like any intellect which is not part of a body. He's thinking angels. So therefore the Torah doesn't need to say, and if you do mitzvot, it continues to exist. However, if a person sins, then the Torah needs to say there's such a thing as kares, that the neshama can be cut off, because that is not the normal result. Kares is an unusual result. The normal result is the person dies, neshama and body separate, body is inanimate, it's like any other matter, it descends into the earth, and the neshama goes off on its own. That's what should happen. Yeah.
I would still think, of course it's obvious that the neshama lives on, but it's maybe not as obvious that if you do good in this world, the neshama has a different olam haba than if you do bad. I mean, Kari's does kind of prove that there's, it could be cut off, but I think that that's something that still could have been talked about in the Torah.
Correct. That's one of the weaknesses of this school of thought, is that this school of thought is equating persistence of the neshama with reward and punishment, right? And that's not a given. Meaning there's a whole lot more that human beings have come up with in various imaginations of what happens after this world, right? The Vikings have one, the Muslims have their conception of it, everyone has their ideas. The Torah could have told us, even within Torah, we have different explanations of what happens. Right? You have the Gemara that talks about how there are different houses in the next world for different people who achieve different levels in this world. There are people who died on Kiddush Hashem, and there are people who converted to Judaism, and there are people who were perfect their whole lives, and they're Balei Tshuva, and it gives us all these different explanations. I could have used some of that. That's the main weakness in this answer. Is that Iker Chasim and Hasefer. We're still missing an awful lot that the Torah could have told us.
But it could also help answer all the questions. That exact weakness is that the Torah doesn't want us to have a specific, concrete concept of Olam Haba. It is more open.
What do you mean it's more open?
We wouldn't really be able to understand it.
So that's a different
thing. Human being couldn't understand. So that, it's almost answering the question.
Right, but that's a different answer then. That's not the Torah didn't need to tell us this because it's obvious.
No, it's the Torah didn't need to tell us this because we wouldn't understand.
Right, and that's going to be one of the approaches to within the second school. So that's perfect. That, Olam Haba doesn't work as an incentive because you wouldn't get it anyway. But I have to ask. I'll ask it when we get there also, but is that really true? You couldn't grasp it at all? I mean, there's nothing about it that we could have appreciated that would have helped us out.
Isn't it the concept of when the group is there and the neshama has there's the nefesh, the ruach, and the neshama.
Yeah.
And when the yirtzeh comes down, then it's the neshama that comes closer, and they are even to ascend higher. There's more mitzvahs, or there's a death. They're coming through being judged on that day. So how does that affect Olam Haba? The Olam Haba goes higher and higher than the level of Olam Haba is greater when there's more mitzvahs that are attached to that neshama.
Right. So that's a good question. I thought you were going to ask a different question, which is that Ramban says that the neshama doesn't have parts. But the Ramban knows very well that we have all sorts of midrashim as well as ideas within Kabbalah. Ramban is a mekubal. That there's nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, yechida. There are aspects, parts to it. Ramban doesn't really get into that at all here. He seems to pretend it's not there. So that's subject to some debate. Meaning there is the notion that nefesh is the most physical out of the different aspects of the of what you can only call a soul at this point, because you can't use the word neshama because that's different from nefesh. But in terms of the question of what is achieved when mitzvos are done, it really depends on how you understand the whole next world experience. Meaning, if you take the simplest view, which is that a person achieved a certain level in this world, and now they, in the next world, they're able to attach to Hashem based on that, or receive reward, whatever that looks like, based on that, then the answer is, they now have achieved more merit, because mitzvahs were done as a result of that. They spread the idea of learning Torah, of performing mitzvahs, they created descendants, or had friends who they helped strengthen in that regard, and therefore these things accrue to their merit. It's part of their mitzvah bank account, if you will. And that's one way to look at it. There are others who take it a little differently. If you read Ramchal, Ruchayim Balashin, and Nefesh HaChayim, you get the idea that it's more about strengthening the connection between this neshama and Hashem. That the connection itself becomes stronger with the increase in zchus, with the increase in merit.
So it's connected with Olam Haba, or it's more that you're coming closer to Hashem, you're going higher to Kisei Kavod?
Well, that's how we're defining Olam Haba, more or less.
The closer you are to Kisei Kavod, the greater Olam Haba? Is that how
you... I'm using the term Olam Haba maybe differently from the way you're using it. I'm using the term Olam Haba, and this goes back to what I said in the beginning, that it's such a bad term, it's too vague. But Olam Haba, I'm using to mean existence after death. That's the way I'm using that term, yeah. Okay, so this is your first school of thought. Everybody knew about it. There was no point in mentioning it. And the deficiency is that there really are things that you could have told us that no, people did not intuit. The second approach is that Olam Haba doesn't work as an incentive for conduct in this world. And there are a few reasons why that's hard. There are a few approaches, and then there's a reason why it's a hard sell. I just wanted to see how we're doing on time here. Yeah. So, Abarbanel brings a view that Olam Haba does not work as an incentive because it's not a good enough incentive.
Take
a look at source number 11. You're forgetting who the competition is. You're forgetting who the competition is. That's the problem. Take a look at source number 11. Abarbanel. Hachuba hahei. The fifth answer. The people who worshipped idols back in the day, they promised wonderful material success. So when Hashem wanted to make us complete in our emunah, He gave us the Torah. He said, don't worship any of those types of avodah zarah. The fear is when you wean people from avodah zarah, which has been promising them that their fields will do well and their enemies will fall and everything's going to be wonderful, and has been promising them, in general, wonderful, wonderful material gains, or warned of horrible material losses, you can't substitute for that by telling them, well, there's life after death. And in life after death, things will be really nice. Because they're interested in the candy bar. You know, that's the way humans work. Human beings are much more interested in that which they are able to perceive. And he quotes you the Nashim Ha'arurot in Yirmiyahu. But he says, Shine lo ha'iloiyah kein. Abba behefach shabaharchikam me'osin avodos yushpulu aleim bashkachas Hashem togos vatlachas yosir v'yosir le'in shiur. So therefore, what we're responding is, you're not going to suffer what they say you're going to suffer. You will not lose all of the benefits that they promise, just the opposite. The less you do in terms of avodah zarah, the better off you will be materially. So this view says the weakness of the other the weakness of promising Olam Haba is that it's just not going to be compelling for people. That's the idea. Yeah.
So this is very good for those times, because in those times that people serving Olam Haba, they promised this. But the Torah is for all times, and then like if you look like later, like in the times of the Maravanel, where the Christians promise afterlife. So then, all of a sudden, when you're counteracting, you know, the competition is promising an afterlife, and you're not.
So right. So that's part of where I'm going in terms of the deficiency in this overall school. I'm going to make it, you know, a bigger problem, which is that the track record for the religions that promise afterlife is actually pretty good. They got people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. We're still getting, if you're a Muslim,
it's much easier.
I can't hear you.
The Muslims today are being promised that they're going to be martyrs for their afterlife. They're doing it today.
It's much easier to promise afterlife because you don't have to prove anything.
Right.
When you promise material wealth and then the person is poor, then and they're so good, then how do you explain that, right? So
right. No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, Rav Sadia Gaon, that I brought you at number 8, his second answer is along the same lines, where it says Hashenit, the end of the second line. Prophecy, the messages that we get in Nevuah, tend to expand on that which is immediate. V'tiktsar v'dvar harachokim doesn't talk as much about that which is far away. V'kasher ha'yatsar ha'am be'ish nidna lehem ha'torah v'yidiyas inyan eretz kanan kasher asherhim bo'yam e'le'ah herchiv alehem b'feirusho. When we needed to know about what we're going to do in Israel when we arrive, so the Torah told us what you're going to do in the land. And herchiv alehem b'feirusho, it told them about what to do there, u'mamashi yeshmo priyavodasam v'hambarosam, and what will happen if you do what you're supposed to do, and what will happen if you rebel and don't do what you're supposed to do. It's all focused on the land you're about to enter. Right? I had a very long drive on Monday. I drove into New York Sunday afternoon for my sister's thing, Bat Mitzvah. And then the Bat Mitzvah was on Monday. And then Monday afternoon till like after midnight, I drove back. So it was one of those insane, just like 2-day things. And the only way I survived was by downloading a whole lot of audio shiurim and trying to stay awake that way. It works. I'm here. I am proof. So I heard a shiur on Bechukosai where someone made a very interesting point. I think it was Rav Ari Khan. Made an interesting point. We have these two appearances of the Tochacha in the Torah, these warnings of punishment. One of them is here. One of them is in Kisavo. Why do we have two? I mean, I said in the beginning today that there are differences between them, but why are there two at all? What's going on in the Chumash? So the answer is this one is at the end of Sefer Vayikra, because we're about to enter the land. That's what's supposed to happen at this stage. Yeah, at the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar describes how the Shvatim travel, and we leave Har Sinai, and then Meraglim. But we were supposed to go straight into the land. So this is about what things will be like in the land that you're coming to. The problem was the Meraglim. So then you need a do-over, because it isn't until for another 40 years that we're ready to enter the land. And so once again, in Sefer Devarim, you get, this is what's going to be within the land. It makes a lot of sense.
Can't you say reference?
Reference what we said 40 years ago. So here's what I said. So no, but first of all,
for us, I mean, it's one thing if it was was said twice, but we don't need to read it twice.
Correct. But there I would point out that there are substantive differences. Moshe speaks differently to the Jews at the entry into Israel than Hashem speaks at the end of Sefer Vayikra. That's already, the Gemara already notes that and talks about some of the differences. Moshe doubles the curses, over what you see here. But also, in the one that Hashem gives here, the focus is if you don't listen, if you don't listen, if you don't listen. Whereas in Kisavo, it's actually because you didn't serve Hashem with simcha, with joy. It's a different angle on what the Avera is. And it plays out in terms of what the warnings are and so forth. There are substantive differences between the two that warrant it being left in, including it for us. Not to mention, if someone has a chance to tell me something that Moshe Rabbeinu said, I'd like to know. Don't tell me, just look back at, But in terms of what we're saying here, the point that Abarbanel is making here and that Rasaja Gaon is adding as well, it makes a lot of sense. You're about to enter Israel. Tell me about the Israel things. Don't tell me about something which either is too far away, it's not where I am right now, or don't tell me about this thing which doesn't compete with the Avodah Zarah promises. The Avodah Zarah promises, those look good. Tell me about life after death is not so germane. Okay, but that's one idea within why it doesn't work as an incentive. It's too distant. Another element of why it wouldn't work as an incentive is the opposite of what we said before. We said before almost the opposite. We said before that the reason not to mention it is because it doesn't, it doesn't add anything. Everybody already knew it. Well, Ibn Ezra has a different take in number 12. And this goes back towards what Dasi had said. Ulafi da'ati, in my view, Shatara ne'na lakol, Torah is given to everybody. Lo la'achad abado, not just one person. Udvar ha'olam haba lo yavino achad mini elef. Kiyomoku, he says, olam haba, not comprehensible. No one's going to grasp it. Even one in a thousand would grasp it. He says it's too amok, it's too deep, and therefore I wouldn't include it in the Torah. It's too hard for people to grasp it. So we've gone from one end of things, which is it's obvious, everybody knows it, to then no one will believe you. No one will comprehend it at any rate. Now you could distinguish and say it's not that no one will comprehend Olam Haba, it's that no one will comprehend the specifics when you try to tell it to them. But again, I don't really know what that means. Like, you couldn't have told me something. There's nothing that I could have grasped.
It's like you're saying, people say, like, you gotta see it to believe it. Like, it's so large, it's so larger than life that if we would even try to give you a little bit of it, it wouldn't bear to it.
But is that, I mean, do you think so?
No, if you say something's amazing going to happen, I can't really explain, or you still know.
Even that, even just to say that sentence.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Believe me, but there's something good coming.
Something good coming.
Right. We have a pasuk. The problem is it's a Navi. Ayin La Ra says, no one has seen it. A different version of this is found in Abarbanel, number 13. Hebrew is the bottom one side, English is at the top of the next side, where he says, Hakadmonim, Kol Zera Adam Ubnei Noach Zulasi Yechidei Sgula B'Shem Ve'Eber V'Avram Kulam Obdim L'Kochavim U'Makchishim Hashkachas Hashem B'Fratei B'Nei Adam. He says all those early people, the descendants of Adam and Noach, other than the special people, Shem, Eber, Avraham, other than those, everybody served Avodah Zarah. Everybody denied that Hashem watches what happens in this world. And those who believe that the world always existed followed them. They denied that God supervises the world. Lachain, therefore, end of the second line in the Hebrew. Kisharata Kadosh Baruch Hu Lizakos Es Yisrael, when Hashem wanted to give us merit, Sidir Lefnehem Ma'asim Asher Yasu Lahodi'am, Sha'olam Kulo Nivra Acher Ve'ein Acher Ha'ayin Hamuchlat. Hashem told us what we should do, what our mitzvahs are, what our averos are that we should not do, in order to show us that He's watching, that He's paying attention to what goes on in this world. Hashem wants to show us value in this world, and the way that he's going to do it is by promising reward and punishment here. If Hashem just talks about where they're going to go next, what's going to happen afterwards, the people will not even grasp that as a motive for mitzvahs averus. They need to see some kind of correspondence between things here. Of course, the answer to that is, well, then why don't we? And we see promises of correspondence, but in our experience, we don't see correspondence, and we're always told, you're not going to see correspondence. Schar mitzvah v'haya amaleka, and so on. So this is an answer. I'm not so convinced. And the Rambam, though, has a similar idea when it comes to Tchias HaMeisim in number 14, where the Rambam says that, which was the one that I wanted. Yeah, I see that we're running very low on time. So I'll just do it in the English, halfway through, after the three dots. And he did not transport them from matters of this world with reward and punishment, and he continued thus until these cornerstones were strengthened and held as true for the flow of generations, and no doubt remained in the prophecies of the prophets and the creation of signs. And then the prophets told us that which God had told them of resurrection of the dead, for then it was easy to accept this. He's dealing with why Tchias HaMeisim only shows up in Navi, doesn't show up in Chumash. And yes, the Gemara has hints that it tries to identify in Chumash, but there's nothing explicit. And he says, yeah, because people never would have accepted it. Tchias HaMeisim? No one's going to believe that. First, you have to get people to believe in basic reward and punishment, in basic mitzvos, in the idea that Hashem created the world, the idea that there's prophecy. And then, once you've got that down, then you can talk about Tchias HaMeisim, that people who are dead are actually going to come back to this world. So that's your second school of thought. Your first school of thought is, well, first of all, just to sum up, we said that as far as I can see, the Torah and the culture in which the Torah is given believe in life after death. That's not the question. The question is, why not say so? Why are you giving us this material focus? So our first answer was unique to Parshas Bechukosai, which is the Torah is speaking to the community here. Life after death is individual. It's personal. But then the broader point is that the Torah wants to encourage proper behavior. And that's the message, that's the motivation for what the Torah chooses to tell us. So one school of thought says everybody knew about this. The chiddush, the novelty, was material benefit. So that's what the Torah is going to tell us all about. And we saw Rav Haigo and one other take it, Abba Benel. But that's basically that school of thought. And then the second school, but the weakness being that you're missing specifics. Even if it's expected, nonetheless, you're not getting specifics. And then the second school of thought is that Olam Haba doesn't work as an incentive for proper conduct in this world, either because it doesn't match the promises of Avodah Zarah and doesn't relate to the land of Israel they're about to enter, or because people can't wrap their minds around it, and Torah is for everybody, and there's a need to speak about things that people can perceive in this world, which was, I think, Rav Sadia Gaon's initial approach, the one that I mentioned earlier. I think that was what he was trying to say in his first answer. But what we still have not seen is the idea that having this kind of information, talking about Olam Haba, could actually lead to bad behavior, to what God does not want us to do. I'll give you just a 1 second summary of the basic idea, because this is the most common answer that I hear to the question of why the Torah doesn't speak about Olam Haba explicitly, is because then people will focus on the next world. Instead of doing what you're supposed to do here, your thought becomes the next world is the ikar. The next world is really what matters. Hashem wants us to focus on doing what we're supposed to do here. There's more to say about that for after Shavuos. And then we'll get to the Kuzari's approach, which is unique and novel, and basically his idea that you can achieve Olam Haba here, why talk about achieving it after death? And we'll see what that means, God willing, when we convene in 2 weeks. Sorry? I will bring new sources. Don't worry about it. I need a volunteer.